When I met Sakina, I couldn't understand half of what she'd say. Part of the problem is that I am not from around here, but the other part of the problem, the part that I'd like to talk to you about tonight, is the simple fact that I can't keep up with Sakina. But this is not merely a Maria issue. Find me a man who says he can keep up with Sakina, and I will declare that man a dishonest man. But the speaking fast is not all. Sakina moves fast. You are at a party and decide you need a napkin. Well, by the time you're back, Sakina has hugged a room full of strangers because she has found out who they are at their core and also accepted them for who they are. What I'm saying is that Sakina beats Newtonian physics. Sakina actually laughs in the face of Newtonian physics. And her speaking fast is really just a reflection of the general ridiculous speed of her spirit, perpetually breathless in its love and curiosity for life. Sakina is writing fiction. Sakina is at the beach with Yvel. Sakina is doing some badass cardio. Sakina is writing poems. Sakina is driving you everywhere. Sakina is reading. On some moments, I have even wondered if Sakina doesn't own one of those magical clocks that stop time. And I am here to tell you, friends, that of course she does. I have discovered such clock hidden inside Sakina's fingertips. And I've discovered it becomes activated when she writes. Otherwise, how would you explain, oh, the places she goes? Sakina is following a group of sex workers mourning outside Whitney Houston's funeral. Sakina is following a family of Neanderthals who are being ostracized in the suburbs. Sakina peeps inside the keyhole to a family home in Newark. Sakina is there when the world ends. Let me illustrate how this works. When Sakina hands you a story or a poem, she will hand you a very soft, strange bird and then walk away. She won't tell you what it means and she won't give you any explanations. She won't try to throw confetti on your face. She will hand it to you without a box. You will feel its warmth in your palm. You will feel its tiny heartbeat. And yes, it'll freak you out. But for a moment, time will stop because you are so mesmerized by the bird, you forget you're holding it in your hand. You will even forget you have a hand. You will forget you have anything. You will forget you. And the feeling of the bird will be so close to you that at one point you swear you are the bird. And when the story ends, you will remember you're in fact holding a bird, and you will realize the bird is actually quite warm. It's actually kind of burning your hand. And so you will let the bird go, and this bird will leave you with this difficult warmth you don't know what to do with. Which of course then leads you to become the kind of person who loves getting burned, a pyromaniac who is always searching for a story that feels like that, like hot coals and self-oblivion. But what are you gonna do? At least you say you lived your life, right? Sorry to tell everyone, love, how you do your thing, but I thought we could all use a little lesson in time expansion from your spirit, which I am so thankful is so naturally high on speed.
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. I really appreciate it. Thank you, Maria, for that awesome introduction. I love you. And I'm happy to be up here reading, and I'm happy to be reading with Rob Talbert, who's one of my favorite poets in the program. So thank you all. Tonight, I'm going to read two poems and a short fiction story. I guess I'll begin. Everyone can hear me, right, in the back? Yes. Thanks, Kappa. All right, the first poem is titled Uncle, because we all have one, I guess. Uncle, for years, we watched you try to shrink into a baby ball so you could spread your mother's legs and crawl back into her womb. You and your pipe bomb dreams of sons or sons of sons playing ball for the NBA who will help you retire from the career you never had with magic money, or the niece you believe will make you millions writing the family secrets. I've checked, the words are dark and there are no diamonds in them. Once upon a time, you prostrated before heroes, the same ones who tasked you with rolling rusted rundown cars up Hooper Hill under a blazing sun that snickered when you never got one over. Your friends, Amatol, Phenobarbital, weren't any help. The devil had unzipped your skin and settled in. We watched Grandma set fire to the trash in the backyard, wait for her to push you in, burn you back into a man. Once upon a time, before your breath smelled of Robitussin mixed with whiskey, before your nostrils were rimmed with bits of crushed volume, you gathered Sid and me in your arms, swimming us round and round. We were flying, looking up at you, and those possible pine needles brushing our Carolina blue sky. And so for my next poem, and also the short story, is about Newark. I actually couldn't write about Newark, and so I left Newark, which is kind of weird. There's good things in Newark. I am not a representation of Newark. There are good things, but I think I'm just trying to exercise the negative out. All right, so poem and a short story. I decided to stop writing about the hood. No more street pharmacy tells. No more who stole whose crack, who got shot over bad crack, whose aunt is high on crack, whose baby ate a little crack, whose corner sells the best crack or 5-0 crackdowns. There were too many babies birthing babies, too many hours on the clock, too many foot skins thin. No child left behind brought 10th graders to my after-school program who couldn't add, subtract, pronounce retention, recidivism, or gentrification. They learned from North School of Hard Knocks how to stand on the opposite side of the class, wave red or blue flags, and say, blood love overcomes our depressions, or continuous revolution in progress. After strapping the tables, forced conjugation, multiplication, and real division in their ears, iron respectability onto their skins. Then one day, I heard about the four kids who had managed to escape and attend Dell State, home for the break, all shot execution style by flag wavers only 4 blocks away. So next week, when my student screamed she ain't gotta do shit but stay black and die, I told her, Kiana, baby, you're so absolutely right. No more white tees graffitied with RIPs. No more mothers kneeling next to dead sons. No more dead sons. See, I wish I could stop writing. And thanks again. This one's called Newark Pastoral. They laughed. It sounded like the polite chuckle of two strangers slightly amused about fickle weather, rather than a father truly trying to amuse his daughter. After opening up the ticket, he said, I walked back to the office and found a virus eating up my hard drive. Of course, it would be the same day our client Huso in Bellevue shows up. Ha ha ha, Leanne said, you're so funny, Daddy. He sat at the head of the table. Leanne sat next to him in the seat she always sat in when there had been four of them instead of two. He still wore his work shirt and his tie, though loosened, still dangled from his neck. She wore the uniform she had pulled on just before entering the house, which still bore her sister's name. What he did say next, how he helped his client with what he knew until the files were recovered on his secretary's computer, how the client was pleased, and how he found a second ticket on his car. He ripped that one up also. Daddy, you can't keep tearing those up. If you don't pay, they're gonna arrest you. What he didn't say. How he had actually spent hours scrolling through CNN, MSNBC, Inter.com, the missing and exploited children's sites, but clicked on an ad titled, Looking for Kara? This ad led him to a website that included the perky nipples of a porn star named Kara Lovely that was not his Kara, and a virus. Or how he hadn't realized he'd even ripped up the second ticket until he saw shreds of paper littering the ground. The name scrawled on the tag of the shirt the daughter wore and the name the father searched for on the internet was Carol Singleton. The two of them rarely mentioned that name. No one removed the picture that sat on top of the mantle of the four of them laughing at Myrtle Beach. No one made the favorite dish of barbecue chicken. No one spoke of how Leanne started to resemble Kara. No one disturbed the mother that lay in the bed all day, every day, next to a stack of unread books and dusty magazines. No one discussed how he or she wished Kara had been abducted instead of choosing to walk out on her family. What Leanne did say next, how Danny Jimenez had erased her name and scribbled his own on top of her trigonometry homework. She would have never found out he'd stolen it had Ms. Mesos not called out the names of the only four students who had handed in work that day. Oh, her father said, you're such a smart girl, woman, young adult, always paying attention. Well, Leanne didn't say. How that incident had occurred over a week ago, the last day she attended school, how she'd been so mad at Danny, not just for the theft, but also at how easily he had erased her name and replaced it with his own, that she marched across the classroom and drew her hand back to slap him, and stopped herself just in time. How she spent the last week and a half walking past known drug houses in Newark. How today, at 65 Baxter Terrace, she finally glimpsed a pair of the slightly familiar studded BB jeans, jeans she had borrowed on multiple occasions without asking. Those jeans sat on the frame of a skinny woman who resembled Kara, if Kara had lost 30 pounds and aged 6 years. Leanne pulled out her mobile phone and pretended to take a call until the possible Kara skipped out of her line of sight. Not hurried, not walked, skipped. Leanne said, I tried, Daddy. The father stretched, yawned, and lied when he said he had work to do. Leanne mimicked him and even made a show of tossing her book bag over her shoulder and taking labor steps up the stairs. And now this. The mother lay on a large bed. She once been a professor of physics at Montclair State University. When she brought one daughter, then the next into this world, she took a brief break from work. When the first one left, she took an indefinite sabbatical and relished in the discovery of Netflix, particularly Law & Order SVU. She was fascinated by the multitude of crimes that could be solved neatly in under an hour. If the detective was called the criminal halfway through an episode, there would be a trial. If not, they would certainly catch the perp by the end. She loathed unsolved cases and kept a special detailed list of the ones that left her with too many questions. That way, every time she started rewatching from episode one, she knew which episodes to skip. Leanne pushed open the door at the sound of the familiar dun dun. Before Kara left, the daughters would politely knock on their parents' door and wait for permission to enter. On separate occasions, each daughter had the experience of walking in on her parents in uncomplimentary positions. That was before. Something else had happened with the mother last year, something no one discussed, and the lock and the knob had been removed. "Kara," the mother said, "no, it's me." "Of course it is. Come now, give me a hug." Leanne pretended not to smell a damp funk. She pretended not to notice her mother's curls lining up on her head, like mother, like possible Kara, because she too had lost weight, and she too looked to be much older than her age of 46. Leanne air kissed her mother's cheeks. "How was school?" "The same." "That's nice." "Got an A on history test." "Oh, that's nice." "Dun dun." Leanne watched the opening with her mother. After precisely 50 minutes had elapsed on the clock, the one hanging on the wall that no one had bothered to change after daylight saving times began, ended, then began again, Leanne stood up and went to her room. "Tomorrow," Leanne promised herself, "I'll go back to school." How Leanne happened to start searching drug houses. Step one, threw a tantrum in Kara's room, opted to fling comforters and clothing rather than anything noisy such as lamps or mirrors. Step two, realized how deeply upset her mother would be to see Kara's disheveled room. Decided to fold and place all the clothing back in their proper drawers. Step three, picked up Kara's underwear and became angry when she realized she hadn't even been cognizant of touching and throwing her sister's underwear. Step four, place underwear back in underwear drawer. Brush fingers against something plastic taped to the top of the drawer. Step five, put out baggie, examined it, tentatively smelled it. Step six, dug deeper and found a smooth glass pipe. Step seven, hid the smaller baggie and the pipe in a sandwich bag and kept them in her own underwear drawer, wrapped inside a pair of period panties. Leanne never had to worry about her parents finding it. No one entered her room. No one lay on her bed, staring up at the fan whirling in circles, imagining where she could be. Leanne didn't go back to school. There was evidence she tried. She put on Kara's uniform, placed her chemistry, history, programming, and literature books into her book bag. She used her last train ticket to ride the light rail downtown to her Magnet High School, but when the train stopped at Military Park, she remained on board. She didn't get off until she reached the final stop, North Penn Station. The McDonald's bathroom at the station had proven to be useful. The handicapped stall was the only one that still had its purse intact. She hung her uniform from it while she pulled on her leggings. Unfortunately, she had difficulty fitting her bulky uniform pants in her book bag. She rolled them, folded them, and then rolled them again until she screamed, "Fucking fit, you fucking motherfucker, what the fuck would you fucking fit? Fuck you!" She pulled her least used book, C++ Programming Made Easy, from her bag and threw it into the garbage. The zipper closed. The distance between McDonald's and 65 Baxter Terrace was approximately 1.24 miles, give or take the 0.3 miles she added to take the route less frequented by the truancy task force. A side note on 65 Baxter Terrace. Project apartments arranged in the genius shape of an X, each angled with a courtyard. Each courtyard had two metal garbage cans chained to a tree. Each metal garbage can stood empty, yet surprisingly, each courtyard was littered with crushed soda cans, crumpled fast food wrappers, unread newspapers, sticky gum, and crates. One courtyard stood out because of the stroller missing two wheels that lay on its side. Eventually, a developer would purchase the property, tear it down, and build high-rise condominiums where he would charge 3 times the rent the current residents pay. The construction will give its new tenants who live on floor 6 and above lovely views of downtown Manhattan. The original builder had probably decided projects were projects for a reason and purposely stopped building at 5 stories, giving everyone a panoramic view of a concrete slab and trees. Sometimes during the winter, a few of the current residents climbed to the roof where they were able to admire the New York City skyline through shivering branches until, of course, they got cold or caught one. In other words, her section of Newark homes, not just houses, yards, present parents, overhead plants decorating front porches. This section, broken bottles, dreams, and car windows. The front door of building 65-1 opened, and a doughy lady with a walker walk-rolled her way out of the building. When she neared Leanne held up a photograph. "Have you seen my sister?" The woman, clearly used to being asked strange questions by strangers, pushed her walker around Leanne without answering. A mother gripping the hands of rambunctious twins dressed in matching miniature giant jerseys shook her head at Leanne's question. Leanne didn't ask the couple who were scratching themselves when the children had ran by her hollering. During the downtimes when the foot traffic slowed, Leanne looked up at the picture. It had been taken nearly 2.5 years ago at Macy's for the Christmas cards. The last year her mother would mail Christmas cards to family members. The photographer had gotten frustrated with them. Her mother had a sneezing fit. Kara's lipstick kept rubbing up on her teeth. The 2-year age difference had shot Kara 2 heads above Leanne, who kept trying to balance on her toes and falling over. Her father released a loud fart, so loud that the photographer had said a number of expletives before storming out the room. They finally got a normal picture with the 4 of them smiling and touching. Leanne continued to hold up this picture and asked until about 11:30 when she walked around the building to the 65-2 entrance and began her questions anew. A set of Mormons, dressed in their white shirts and tan trousers, told her they hadn't seen Kara. Another woman in a rumpled skirt suit, who might have been from child services, saw it when she saw the picture and said, "Be with me today, Jesus." A man rocking a crisp tan tee sauntered over to her. "What's good? Have you seen my sister?" He stared at the picture, then at Leanne. "Y'all look just alike. Not this picture, but now you do. Matter of fact, you look better. Why don't you come inside and see her? She's in my living room, right in the sofa." Leanne's legs wobbled, and a man led her over to her crate where she sat for a moment, breathing in and out. "There you go," he said. "It's better if you come inside. I can get you some water, and you can see your sister." She nodded and stood. He led her to the door of 65-2, rubbing her shoulders with one hand while fumbling in his pants pockets with the other. When they reached the main door, he pulled out a key out of his pocket. "What's her name?" Leanne asked. "Who?" "My sister." "Jessica, Keisha, Sharonda." Leanne took off running down the street. Behind her, the man yelled, "Apartment 4F, come on, beautiful, where you going?" Leanne didn't stop running until she could no longer hear his voice, and even then, she continued to jog until she reached the subway entrance. Here are some ways North Kendall's truant students. 1, send burly men dressed in plain clothes, normally a t-shirt and jeans, to ride around in white vans with blacked out windows. They will ride up on you and swing the door open so quickly, you won't have time to run. You first notice the handcuffs the men hold, then a red-eyed, sniffling teenager's handcuffed to a pole affixed to the van ceiling. The men won't bother with pleasantries such as hellos and smiles, then demand an ID. Take note, future pedophiles and serial killers. You will have a higher success rate of kidnapping and murder if you study their tactics. Or 2, if truancy fails, they really do, they're just too damn good, the school will call the house and leave a message. Leanne had been lucky with number 1. She knew which roles to avoid. Number 2 had worked in her favor because her mother ignored all calls from North public schools, whom she assumed wanted to inform her that Carol Singleton had missed yet another day of school. North public schools left a voicemail that Leanne erased before her father arrived home. It had worked the past week and a half. On Thursday, it did not. The daughter walked in to find her father sitting on the sofa. "Oh," Leanne said, "you scare me. You're 1 day away from failing your junior year." "I'm going back, Daddy. I just need time." "Is that what you call one in your life? Time?" Both father and daughter had more in common than each realized. The father had also played hooky, except he called it taking a sick day. He watched episodes of Law and Order with his wife, then drove around Vilsburg section of Newark, searching. "I swear, Daddy, I'm going tomorrow, I promise." Again, both of them stared into space, a space where things probably needed to be said, but never would. Her father dropped her off at school the next day, not just dropped her off. He parked in front of the no parking at any time sign and walked her inside the school. Security ran metal detectors over both of them and made him sign in. The junior homerooms were located on the 3rd floor of the building. The bell buzzed when it reached the 3rd landing. "You're late," he said. "I'm here. I'll make it. Your mother will pick you up at the school, okay? Have a good one. You too, Daddy." In her classroom, no one batted an eye over Leanne's absences, not even her homeroom teacher, Mr. Nkosi. He once been Kara's homeroom teacher also. Perhaps Leanne was simply doing what they all expected. By 2:45, Leanne's mother had not shown up. Leanne called the house phone at her mother's cell at 3 o'clock. No response. At 3:15, Leanne walked down Rector Street, joined the hordes of other students across Military Park, and hopped on a city subway without purchasing a ticket. The stop for her house was Branchbrook, but she got off at Warren Street, which was a reasonable walking distance to Baxter Terrace. When she exited, she noticed the transit cops making their way across the platform, so she hurried in the opposite direction, up the stairs. Leanne did not see her sister in front of her and ran smack into her. There were no bellows, no red carpets, no sirens. Only the younger sister apologizing profusely to the stick-thin woman she knocked down, then silenced when she realized that woman was Kara. Leanne knew she should help her sister to her feet. The dismayed glances of the woman hurrying past them seemed to tell her so, but she couldn't look away. Kara, who had loved makeup counseling sessions at Sephora, was dirty. Red blisters dotted her face, and her entire lower lip was white and flaking off. "Leanne," Kara said. Her voice hadn't lost its amber tone, but it was high-pitched and quick. Kara popped up and smiled at her. Leanne, look at you. Oh, my God. You're my baby sister, almost grown up now. Kara started pacing back and forth on a single subway step. God, you're looking good. You look good, girl. The blue BB jeans were now black stained stiff and dangled low enough on Kara's thin frame for Leanne to glimpse about an inch of Kara's thick pubic hairs. Leanne had seen enough and understood. One, her sister needed to come home. Two, that if she were, things would never be the same, because three, Kara needed rehab. This was bad, really bad. For a moment, Leanne did what we all do when we picture ourselves as heroes. In her head, she managed to keep Kara still while she called her father. In her head, Leanne remained calm as she explained where she was and how he needed to come right away. He picked them up, they struggled, and Kara needed a full year of rehab. However, when Kara returned, she returned healthy. She grew her hair back out, made several supportive friends, cheered Leanne on as she graduated salutatorian for class. In time, Kara got her shit together, got her GED, then fulfilled her long lost dream of becoming a counselor. Every once in a while, the two of them drove down to Jersey Shore. They sat on beach chairs and stared at the questionable green brackish water. Kara often got misty-eyed and told Leanne, "Thank you. No. Here's what really happened." Kara said, "I gotta go. Don't you want to come back? Please, Nita." The next words exploded from Kara's mouth. "Don't tell me what to do. Everyone's always telling me what to do. Gotta go. Kara jogged up the stairs in the direction of Baxter Terrace, and Leanne struggled to keep up with her. Kara, the anti-smoker, pulled a cigarette from her back jean pocket and managed to light it while running. He turned around and shouted, "Leanne, what? Leanne wanted to ask, how, why? Maybe for some things in life, there were no clear answers. Leanne's heart rate quickened as they neared 65 Baxter Terrace and quadrupled as they passed it and made it right onto Colden. Colden was a narrow street and a site of a horrific three-house fire 2 years ago. The houses were scorched sites of melted siding, rusted pipes, gaping holes for windows, and piles of molded junk. Kara climbed up steps of the one in the middle, the only house that still had steps. "Please, Leanne, can you just come home with me? We miss you." Kara laughed slow chuckles like the ring of church bells. "Ha, ha, ha. I miss me too." Cue the violin, zoom out to show the two of them standing on the rickety steps of this burnt down horror house. The only other person on the street was the woman wearing nothing but a patched coat, pushing a shopping cart past them. Zoom into Kara's face, cut to Leanne's face. Leanne looks cross, somewhere between holding back tears and trying not to slit her sister's throat. "I'll think about it," Kara said. She pulled the cigarette out of her mouth, stomped on it six times, then picked up the cigarette stub and placed it into her back pocket. She walked up two more steps, then held out her brown, bruised, mottled hand. "You got some dollars, like five, maybe $2.50? Leanne passed her a 10. Kara took it and said, you wanna come in? You wanna come spend some time?" Leanne nodded. Okay, let's do this. Kara opened the door and Leanne got a whiff of the inside. It smelled like something had died, been resurrected, then died again. Leanne backed away from her sister. Kara would jiggle on one leg then the other, as if she never stopped moving. Leanne hurried down the steps and down the street, never turning back, and making sure to walk extra quickly past 65 Baxter Terrace. When Leanne arrived home, she stripped off her uniform and discarded it in the garbage. She changed into sweats, then opened the door of her mother's room without knocking. "You forgot to pick me up." "Kara, goddammit, no, it's Leanne. I had to walk home." Her mother turned to her surprised. "You walked?" Then looked at the broken clock. "Damn, I'm so sorry. Leanne closed the door before she could witness her mother crying. Leanne waited for her father to return. She wanted to wait until both of them sat at the table and he scooped the first bit of food into his mouth. Then she tell him. She told him everything she saw. "Leanne," he would say, "why didn't you say anything before? Leanne, why didn't you call the cops?" And she would not answer. She would enjoy him saying her name in a number of different pitches and pleas. Once he realized she wasn't going to answer him, he would shake her. He would come the closest he's ever been in his life to striking her. Then she'd cry and mumble something about Baxter Terrace and Colden Street. He'd run to his car and reverse on the driveway, and she would sit back down at the table spooning bits of mediocre tiki marsala in her mouth mimicking him. "Leanne, why don't you tell me? Leanne, answer me. Leanne." And she'd say, "Fucking answer, Leanne. Fucking talk, Leanne. You're supposed to save her. Well, fuck Carrie. Well, fuck Kara, Daddy. Fuck her." Thank you.
Yeah, needs no introduction.
Robert Edgadias Geffington Buford Talbert is a poet, a tequila aficionado, a lobbyist for nightclubs, and as far as I can tell, he is also an undefeated arm wrestling champion. Now, admittedly, I've only ever seen Rob arm wrestle once, and even that title match was cut very short when the entire table broke and completely disintegrated out from underneath the combatants. Rob came out of it like out of some trance, gripping the other man's arm in his right hand, and in his left, one of the table legs, the jagged fragments of the table top, still attached. Perhaps one incomplete match does not a champion make, but still he did not lose. And in my book, for whatever that counts, you are undefeated, my friend. A proud native of San Antonio, Texas, Rob has famously worked a myriad of jobs, as you may or may not be aware, he has worked in a bookstore, at a restaurant, for a bar, in an office, on a cruise ship, as a corrections officer in a jail. Though these places and titles may provide some raw materials for his writing, they speak nothing about where you must look in order to find Rob. He is, after all is said and done, in the poems themselves, inside the concentrated confessionals. Rob then has appeared in Alaska Quarterly, American Poetry Review, New York, Ohio, Jupiter, Painted Bride Quarterly, Quarterly, Passages North, Rattle, Southern Poetry Review, Daily, among many others. In addition to the nominations he receives as one of the best poets, he has also received two Pushcart nominations. Last year, his book, Jagged was published by Mad Hat Press. It is a mason work collection of poems built by Talon's hands on two other floors. Thus, so precisely to the depths of memory, the fearful sensation of cement around your ankles, or a kind of resurrection owning laser skirts and recital neon lights. Jagged pieces, sure. Fragments of nostalgia lost. Rob's work reminds me of that wonderful, yet now it sounds like an old film projector starting up, in the way you used to listen to it in the dark, just before your eyes fill with light-lighting images. Like that moment, these poems will also shift on you, suddenly, violently, intimately, making your eyes quickly twitch just with dazzling. And it may take you a minute or two before you realize your life ends a minute or two locked in an unexpected phrase, distant trajectory, that memory thought you'd left at home before you came out tonight. But as Rob will also remind us, such lost things are never without their romance. See, there is an old rule of thumb in filmmaking that holds you always soak to streets whenever you are going to shoot them at night to make them look as if it just finished raining. That kind of romance for the street, and for the night places to which they deliver us is very much alive in Rob's poems. They are a dance for the willingness to suspend one's disbelief. Poems that always keep one eye open for happy endings, but are too appalled to ever believe them again. You ought to always keep Rob's poems close. Always within arm's reach so you can find them easily on the nights when the parking garage turns you towards some search for profound human understanding. When you are pulled up short by local colors, gravy at a greasy spoon, or the familiar face of strangers, these poems, Rob's poems, will help you figure all that out. So please join me in welcoming my dear friend Robert Talbert to the stage.
Goddamn, you should work for Hallmark. Drinking in the car for 45 minutes before buying panties. Everybody needs a hobby. The parking lot yawns in front of Academy, and we are sticky in rum and soda. Two belligerent news anchors reporting our day to one another. We watch the mothers in the just off of work carry fishing poles, jostle barbecue grills, and other tools for carnage. We make up little narratives about them. The guy building a treehouse for someone else's kids. the woman secretly terrified of her neighbor. The stories are never all the way tragic, but never paradise, like Tuesday, like this town. We are in no hurry. We never are when we drink in parking lots. Talking better than we do over fresh candles and steak, better than we do in the tirade of the bedroom fan. The car is a container for madness, here in this hedge space, famous for awful music, screaming in traffic. We have found that talking can be a kind of glue holding love together. In this room we take with us, spilling over with voices from the arguments, laughter, despair, and sex in parking lots. The car is my favorite restaurant. The car is my favorite theater. My favorite nightclub and place to make out is the car. May it never die. May the guy working the junkyard crusher see a blinding flash in its last inches, as if his picture were just taken by some terrorist photographer diving back into the crowd. The afternoon is a sinking ship, and we make a relic of the car by walking away from it, like we must do with everything. Tottering inside the store, we have Caribbean breath, rum glazed and incessantly talking, and I have already forgotten all about the car, and we have forgotten what we came here to buy, like the sparrows trapped in the container of the rafters, moving and singing. Fences. The morning is a song about a tumbling earth. The hangover is a song about a tumbling person. And while each has plenty of time, neither will last, and so must find resilience in their recurrences, showing up again and again like a manic solicitor on a street with one house. It is also this way with kissing, and oil spills kissing the mouths of downed cranes in the shrugging Mississippi. If it repeats, you have a warning sign. You have a flare gleaming above the factories and hotels, and yet so little is still expected. The one-night stands are still surprising in their frequency to make use of a friend's couch. Someone lost control, we say. We might say, never again. But the 20 bucks you find in the parking lot and the broken arm glittering on the skating rink floor suggests it's all a kind of toll or homage paid to a god obsessed with zeros, with recalibrating the scales. The sun is a slow admirer, but will sear you if you take too much. When will the next miraculous thing happen? Soon. So, I went to San Francisco for New Year's Eve. But I remembered a better story. So I was spending New Year's Eve one evening with my parents because I'm so cool, and they got into an argument, a big argument, and I walked in on it. I don't know how it starts, but okay. So I walked in, and the date on the calendar was December 31st, 2007, and my father was saying that you call this day New Year's Eve 2007 because it's in the days in the year. And my mother was saying, no, it's New Year's Eve 2008 because it's the eve of 2008. And they were almost at each other's throats over this, right? So my dad in his fury says, you know what? I'm gonna throw a fucking party next year. I'm not gonna invite you. And I'm gonna put on all the invitations New Year's Eve 2009. And my mother says, well, nobody's gonna come to your fucking party because they're gonna think it was for a different year. And he says, well, at least I'll be fucking. New Year's Eve prayer. This has nothing to do with the story. It's 10 o'clock. And already the girls have raccoon eyes from crying amidst the crowd because their boyfriends are too drunk and running their mouths about what's owed to them. Or maybe because the girls are too drunk and having panic attacks about the whales near fishing villages. Fly, thou bottle rocket. Fly until the burst that hunts you breaks your surface, until you spill and smear across California like blood in the water, like mascara in panic. The crowd is cold and counting down. We are having fun. So one of the jobs, or I did work a lot of jobs. I worked in retail. I was a security guard and all the things that Tom said. And one of the things that really kind of haunted me about punching a clock was I was on like a timer, you know? And I started thinking, like, if you broke everything down into the seconds, like how much money you were getting paid like per second and what that meant. I don't know why I torture myself with this shit, but if your heart beats once a second and you're paid $9 an hour, that's 15 cents a minute of heartbeats. You have a minute left to live and it's worth 15 cents. If you break it down to the second, it's 3/1000ths of a cent for one heartbeat. That's what $9 an hour will get you. Clock puncher on Pier 39. Rain had slathered the pier so dark, I thought of chewed tobacco, unwadded and dragged out in sheets above the bay. Which is to say, I was disgusted with where I walked, disgusted with what was saving me from the tide. And there she was, out in the open, at a kiosk oven with no awning, flipping corn dogs over, her hatbill dripping in front of her glasses. It is often hard to tell which people carry rage, which people blame the world more than themselves, who blame the rain more than the act of working out in it. But I knew that look in her eye, because I have poured scalding grease into trucks on Texas hills and frozen on a gravel lot, making sure nobody keyed the luxury cars. It is not so much the desire to quit your job, but the fact that you can't. That putting down the tongs and storming off the chewed up pier is a form of suicide, one they will blame you for and have no sympathy. Working is an act of tolerance. Enduring the Mount Vesuvius rampaging in your chest, ignoring the possibility that you were meant for wild adventure in the moonlight, forgetting that if you were paid $9 an hour, that it was exactly what the booms of your heart were worth. Then again, she could have been perfectly at peace turning corn dogs over, in the rain, on a pier, in winter, in California. And it was all my own disgust with the grease under my nails, with the weather, my own life. And as I watched Alcatraz begin to break barely through the fog, I could hear the pier creaking like it might give way. So every Friday, the apartment complex where I live, they have a bunch of leaf blowers come in, and they do it at like 6 in the morning. You know where I'm going, cool. So it'll, you know, it'll be super early, and here they come. And then, you know, of course I can't get back to sleep after that. So after about I always hate it when they come around, but a couple of weeks ago I just thought, fuck it, I'm writing a poem about this. So this is an ode to the leaf blower. Autumn has draped her wet hair over the county, and I hear the leaf blower from the riverside of sleep. Tiny engine like a hive of metal bees grinding around and losing their minds. The scraping away of ice, the pops of a tattoo removal laser. Why are the sounds of cleansing always so unpleasant? The leaves pile up outside of my apartment because the wind rips the useless from their stations. sneaks them over the threshold and onto the carpet when I leave for work or come home from work, or stand in the doorway at 2 a.m, wishing I still knew of a forbidden bedroom. Oh, leaf blower, sickle swinger of air across the sidewalks, Sharon, if cutting the path was worth the crossing, you push nature back to its fringes, back to the unpracticed looks from girls in junior high, before nothing had been done beyond my breathing, before the words very long ago had anything to do with me. Don't go so soon, leaf blower. I can hear your engine receding beyond my curtains and my locked window that used to be an escape while my parents slept, when the swift panic of the breeze was nothing more than to muffle my journey over the chain link and out to her house. Is that whom it has always been? Has the wind in my bedroom and those brittle arms and her hair and my lungs and this slow, slow billowing always, leaf blower, been you? So another thing I've learned after watching sci-fi movies with friends is, especially PhD friends, is it's really hard for them to turn off the fucking criticism. We watched The Fifth Element the other day. I was like, just enjoy the fucking movie. It's okay, I love them. So I realized that, you know, I can't turn it off either when it comes to a lot of stuff, which is a definite pavement for an Ars Poetica, which I was trying to trace the exact, you know, traditional standard of how I move through a poem. The students are all wearing pastels. And this is where I comment on pastels, that they're not really the colors they're trying to be. A failed attempt at confidence, but a successful pathetic fallacy. And I'll rack my brain for hours and attempt to associate it all with the past, the vibrant azure of a fishing trip, the terra rosa of panties sliding down their levers. Although I've honestly hated fishing all my life, and the first time I got laid at 17, she wasn't wearing any panties. But the reader won't know this. And once the objects and verbs are all connected, I'll crash into some lyric clamoring about the amusement park of existence. The birds keep their distance, so we have one less thing to lose. Sounds like a good start. But birds should probably be sparrows, and things should be reminder of escape. Because it's all a kind of net that I'm caught up in, the memory in October and this poem, rolling out in a coffee shop, Columbia-scented hospital for the bland tongue and my imagination, another lever to slide down when I'm able to do it. Reminded by my hysterically trendy drink, pumpkin spice, that somewhere on the flawlessly flat grass of Indiana is a patch of pumpkins. Blazing orange into gears well beyond the pastel. And I'd much rather be walking there now in the low fog, tracing lost names into their dew instead of these words, which still haven't gotten me to move. Okay, so one of the things that I've been thinking about recently is how just like emotions tend to be like light switches. Like, you know, before the cheeseburger, you really want the cheeseburger. And then after the cheeseburger, you're like, why did I eat that fucking cheeseburger? Or, you know, it can work the other way. Like, I really don't want to go work out. And then you work out, like, yeah, I worked out. I always feel this way. So it's just, I'm also noticing that love kind of works that way too. You know, it changes at different times. Chronoamorous. This is my last poem, so thank you for listening. The love I have for you at 9 a.m. is not the love I have for you at midnight. Same as the wind, still here but now from the south, and all day varying with the relics it billows. Dog hair from a curbside sofa, the taco wrapper backflipping down 9th Avenue. I am talking about garbage because the memory is also what's left over, a soundless ruin of marble columns toppled like lovers in the grass. Morning love is that you didn't laugh when I exited the shower, grotesque and gleaming. Night love is your alacrity for us to flee this inadequate apartment. As debris and garbage smothers the Pacific, may our moments be equally variant, light years from boredom. How patriotic, how passion in the throttle. Where is the color of your hair in the hour I'm kneading in the dye chemicals, wanting a life perfect enough to change, wanting the next hour like snow in the Sahara, wanting it like perfume on the space station. It makes us and it ruins us, you know, going farther than we can see.